Today, worldless Christians and the table between us.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So this topic, the topic for this episode came to mind again in the book, The Human Condition, that I've been reading by Hannah Arendt, which I've talked about many times. The book has provoked, if you're saying, wow, he's using that book for a lot of ideas, you have no idea how many ideas I'm not using that I got from that book. I mean, it's just so rich. So anyway, but there was a particular phrase that was used that came up in The Human Condition that has this whole background to it and a whole list and weight of value to it. And I actually brought the concept up not long ago in a previous episode, but we didn't explore it at all and didn't see where it goes. And it goes somewhere valuable for us, especially during this political season. A lot of times you hear people talk about the language of the kingdom right now. Everyone likes to use that terminology, and there are good reasons for it. It's an important theological term, the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man and so on. Even though really the metaphor is a little antiquated given our current way of seeing the world, we don't have kings in the sense of what kings actually have been historically and what makes them kings. Even in the places that have a monarchy of some kind, it's not the same way we would think of a king in scripture if we could think of it that way. Anyway, the point is that outdated metaphor, it's still important, obviously, because scriptures themselves speak about kingdoms, so we need to understand it, know how to apply it. So that's all fine that we talk about kingdoms all the time. But this is different from that, but it applies to the same issue. And I'm hoping, because of the direct way it applies to everyone in all of history, everywhere, no matter where you live, no matter who you are, no matter what kind of culture you're a part of, it's one of those universal, inherently true things about humanity that having to do with the world that we live in, having to do with what it means to have a world. Because the way we speak about it as a kingdom is, oh, well, we have a dual citizenship, so we're members of this kingdom and we're members of that kingdom. And again, I'm not actually belittling that. It's an accurate way of speaking. Those things are correct and true. But they're not what this is about. When I say Christians are worldless, I mean by that that we, you know, we live in the world everyone else lives in. Obviously, that's how we would think of it. But in another sense, we don't. We are not defined by our world the same way everyone else in that world is defined by it. And that is a part of the vocabulary of Scripture, of the New Testament. It is the case that our creation is made new when we are in Christ. We ourselves become new creatures. The whole creation is different for us because of Christ. And I'm saying that in terms of the creation. That's not even what I'm really referring to when I say world, but that will take some explanation in a moment. But one of the things that, you know, so if I say Christians are worldless, I think what we would be inclined to say in response to that is, well, we have a different world. That's legitimate. We have a different world that we live in, but I don't mean by that a different kingdom. I don't mean a different order of things. I mean something completely distinct from that, and it has to do with the nature of what the world is and how it functions for us. So I'm going to change it. So when I said, today, worldless Christians and the table between us, hopefully I didn't say it exactly like that, but the point is, yes, I mock myself, even when I'm quoting myself. The point is that that table between us is the world. And so what I mean when I say Christians are worldless is that we don't have a table. Now, I know we do have a table. We'll talk about the table we do have later. That's a different conversation in just a moment. We'll get there. But so let me just dwell on that statement for a second. Christians do not have a table. They don't have the same table between them that everyone else does. Let me say it that way. And the table everyone else has between them is the world. Now, I know if I were listening to this, if I were you and I were listening to this, I would be saying, what? This is, what are you even talking about? Come on, get with it here. Okay, so let me bring us into the same kind of language about what I mean by having a table between them. Because we use tables, and I'll explain right now, and I'm getting there. I'm almost there. Just two sentences. Give me a break. We use tables, and I mean tables, like you sit down at the table and you eat with someone, or you have a conversation around the dining room table or around the coffee table, or we have these tables placed everywhere, and it's not just because we need another place to put knickknacks. There's something we use tables for that's very meaningful for us as human beings, and it has to do with how we relate to each other. And the table actually performs these diametrically opposed functions at the same moment of separating and uniting us. And this is not just cleverness with words. I know that when you first consider ideas like this, it can come across that way. Ooh, let's play some games with words. I'm not a big fan of that. And I, believe me, I went through a PhD in humanities, so I saw plenty of wordplay. And all the games that go with it and all the pseudo-intellectualism that can go with that, but also all the intellectual reality that can go with actually grasping some of these concepts that are built into our nature. So I know this one has a legitimacy to it, and partially I'm aware of that, partially just because I've thought through it quite a bit, and I've read through it in so many different authors in so many different ways. But also in my practical experience, I've encountered this. I know this reality. And for, the first time I encountered it was with someone else telling me this was true. It was my pastor when I was a teenager. I remember him saying, now, when I go into a home, because I was going to become a pastor, so he always gave us advice. Well, here's what you should learn. These are, and he gave us very practical advice, how not to drown people when you're baptizing them kind of advice, you know, which is always a useful thing to know. But the point is, he said, oh, you know, I've learned that when I go into a home, if I have an option, I don't want to sit in the living room. I don't want to talk to people around, you know, we're sitting on couches, they're sitting on couches and, you know, whatever. I want to go sit at the dining room table if I can. Now, there are a lot of reasons that that works and makes sense because psychologically, obviously, there's a huge value in community and a sense of belonging in a space when you share a meal. There's an intimacy in sharing a meal that's just built into that experience. I don't know if it's built into the grossness of, you know, people who don't eat with manners, or if it's just the shared experience of having the same flavors and knowing that you've gone through that same very personal process together. Because enjoying, you know, food is very personal. Anyway, the point is, there's a psychological benefit that goes with it, but there's more than that, you know, because I did that. I adopted that method in the hundreds or thousands, and it's thousands for sure, of homes that I visited over the decades that I was in full-time church ministry, home after home after home. If I had the opportunity to say, hey, can we just sit at the table over here? Everybody enjoyed that. We would do it. We would enjoy it. And it did create a completely different conversation and feeling and relationship than sitting with nothing between us on pieces of furniture or standing and talking with nothing between us. Having even that piece of furniture, just a piece of furniture, drawing us together. Oh, here's the space that we're supposed to be at. Here's the boundary. You are on that side of the table. I'm on this side of the table. And we don't sit. No, we don't sit on the table. We don't stand on the table. No, don't stand up. We had rules. You know, we understood. These are the boundaries within which we function around this table. So it separated us in that way. but it also drew us together in that way because we were speaking over the table to each other. That's how we had communication. But I never had to wonder if I was going to bump into someone. I had a table to keep them at bay, right, so to speak. So I learned that it was the thing around which you meet, but it was also the thing that separated you from each other, and that's what we needed in order to have a more transparent conversation and actually a better relationship with each other than we would have been able to have otherwise. And it's the same reason. So by the way, and it doesn't, I'm just, the table, it's not just a metaphor because tables actually do that, right? So the table does it, but the table is a stand-in, not a synecdoche, not just a part of something else that's there, but sort of a metonym for all the other things that accomplish that same task of bringing us together, but also giving us the boundaries that separate us and help us understand how we relate to each other. And it's so for the same reason, sometimes it's really important to have a third person involved in a conversation. In fact, very often, unless you're in a very intimate relationship, it's almost always easier to have a third person involved in a conversation. And that one of those people in that conversation, especially think about it if you're trying to have a conversation with someone that you would find new or maybe awkward. I need to have a critical conversation or whatever. Sometimes those have to happen alone. I get that, but that's challenging. It makes it even more difficult. If you're able to say, hey, we're going to meet and Joe's going to be with us, all right, we're all going to meet, then you have an automatic sort of convenience. That third person, I mean, I don't want to say it this way, but I mean, it is the case. They're the table, you know, they're serving as the table. In one sense, they're helping to bring you together. I mean, even if the other person doesn't know them at all, they're just a conversation piece. Hey, you know, Joe here, he played the same sport you did, and let's talk about that. It's a conversation piece. It, you know, I've already objectified this person so much, it's just an it. But the person is a conversation piece, or they can be a common connection. Hey, we both know Joe, so let's sit down, let's talk about this while he's here. And, you know, he has a common understanding of both of us. He'll know when we're miscommunicating, doing something wrong. So there's a way in which that third person in the conversation serves as a table, not because of where they're standing, just how they are relationally in the conversation. But they also serve to separate you. In one sense, they limit what you can say, because you've got another pair of ears listening. You're not going to be able to say something deceptive if that person knows that it would be deceptive. And also, there's just a matter of courtesy and respect that goes in the presence of someone, and this might add a layer of that to you. But it also provides outlets or escapes from parts of the conversation that stall or become uncomfortable. Well, how about you, Joe? What do you think? And you just turn the other direction and get them involved in the conversation. That's how those kinds of objects work. And so this will be the trickiest leap we have to take. But if you'll go with me, I think you will find this is worth going on. And we're doing this in one episode. So you're not going to have to stick with me for, you know, two different episodes to get through this. One way of understanding what we think of as our world is that our world is all the works by which we create our environment. It's the streets and furniture and walls and dwellings, houses, you know, businesses and gathering places and the, you know, the place down the street where you meet all the people, you know, and the parks and so on. And if you say, oh, so it's just our stuff, because I mean, part of the world is just natural, but even nature, once we map it or measure it or name it or control it, that's when it becomes part of our world. If you're just out in the wilderness lost by yourself, there's a sense in which that's not part of our world. Again, it is because you already have placed it somewhere by the time you're lost in it, but that's a different point. But I'll emphasize this with actually a line from Hannah Arendt from The Human Condition, in a chapter called World Alienation. But this is the quotation. And it's fascinating because think about this. During the period of exploration, right? During the time when we're headed toward the Enlightenment, but before we're in the modern world, so Columbus's explorations and, you know, the Spanish conquering conquering, the Spanish exploring and, you know, having their conquests in Mexico and New Mexico and through the Western United States, and that period when exploration, even into Africa, is just this fascinating expansion of the world. At the same time, we're developing means for travel and so on and creating paths for travel that increase our speed for being able to get there, that increase our ability to be able to get there. Until now, you know, you just fly, or, you know, you fly all the way across the world in a matter of a few hours. And I mean across the world, halfway, you know, around the world in a matter of hours. And a fascinating line, a couple of lines, but it's just, I think, one sentence. It's a really long sentence. In that chapter, puts it this way. So think in terms of the explorers, like a Christopher Columbus type person. Nothing, to be sure, could have been more alien to the purpose of the explorers and circumnavigators of the early modern age than this closing in process. By closing in, we mean the world's getting smaller. We're all connecting with each other. We see tweets from London or movies that come out of Moscow the next day. You know, the news is reported to us from Afghanistan while it's happening. It's a smaller world, and we can get to those parts of the world faster than we've ever been able to do it. So in one sense, the world is so much smaller than it used to be, right, in a lot of different ways. That's what she means by the closing in process. So let me go and read the sentence again. So nothing, to be sure, could have been more alien to the purpose of the explorers and circumnavigators of the early modern age than this closing in process. They went to enlarge the earth, not shrink her into a ball. And when they submitted to the call of the distant, they had no intention of abolishing distance. Their point was to be able to explore the distant. We want to maintain the majesty and transcendence of the top of Mount Everest, which has now become a place that's hiked to regularly by so many multitudes that we're collecting bodies on the side of the mountain. You get the idea. That's the same thing. No matter how distant it is, every time you go there, it becomes closer and closer into the center of the world that is yours. And so this is why, when you look back at it, the way we describe, well, the way we describe America today, it's the new world. I was talking to someone about corn the other day. And, well, that's a new world crop, right? That's how we talk about it. Things are part of the new world or the old world. European explorers believed that they were coming into a new world when they found the West, found for themselves the West Indies, or what came to be known as America later. Though, you know, so the thing is that all of those ingredients, streets and furniture and walls and dwellings and businesses and gathering places, and even the way we've mapped nature so that we can give it a name and say, well, I'm going to that part of the world, I'm going to this quadrant of the world, or whatever it is. Those are the table, the world, that's what the world is, are the table that brings us together and separates us. I'm here, you're there. But we're together because we're in the same world. That kind of idea is what I'm talking about. So sometimes that world, and that means the ingredients, all the things that we've created to understand and control and grasp and comprehend and blah, 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 the things around us that we actually notice, they're sometimes physical, like houses in a neighborhood. And think about it. That's a perfect example. Houses in a neighborhood put us together. We live in the same neighborhood. Well, you live in separate houses. And the neighborhood is defined by having all those walls. The neighborhood that brings us together is defined by the presence of the walls that separate us. It's not just a manipulation of quick and quirky ideas. It's a reality of our nature that we're brought together by the things that separate us. So, and again, I'm getting to something that will make this applicable, especially to those of us who are believers, but I think it's not harmful for all of us to recognize this just as human beings. Sometimes all those materials that bring us together are physical. They're material. Sometimes they're immaterial, like political alignment. You know, I don't need to know the secrets of your soul. I just need to know whether you vote Republican or not. Or we're brought together because we vote Democrat together. Or we're separated by only needing to know of each other that we vote libertarian. And this is the reality. When you come together for that political rally, you don't come together and say, now, wait a minute, which brand of clothing are you wearing? What you're asking is, are you a libertarian or not? Are you a Democrat or not? Are you a Republican or not? The things that bring us together also create a separation by the fact that that's the thing that's bringing us together. So what I want to do is put this into just three steps, three challenges, three ways for us to have to think through things. One of these, the first one, is the most, I'll say ethereal. I'm not going to keep it at the ethereal. But it is the most challenging philosophically for us. We just, it's not in our nature to notice this. So there are three challenges. The first challenge is simply to overcome the naivety that thinks that the world in which we live is simply the concrete material reality of the impersonal cosmos realized by our perfectly objective interaction with it. That's how we think of the word world. We think, oh, I live in the world. I mean, I live in the giant empty box that is space in which our Earth is spinning around. And if we replace that with anything, it's just the concept of the Earth as a dirt ball, you know, a rock floating in space that is our world. That's how we think of it, as if it's purely objective and the world just exists. And I happen to be in it, walking over it, and my knowledge of the world is based on my objective interaction with it. But think of how ridiculous it is to think that that's actually what we mean by the world. I mean, all of the things about that part of nature that we can't even access, we wouldn't even know it existed. We wouldn't know about infrared light or ultraviolet light if someone else hadn't figured out some way to create a mechanism that can interact with it and then show us regular light that makes us think now we can see infrared light. We wouldn't have any concept of X-rays or gamma rays or beta rays or cosmic particles or dim nebula, for crying out loud. I get in my backyard and aim my telescope at a spot in the sky and expose it to that spot in the sky, expose my camera's receptors, you know, sensor, to the spot in the sky for, I don't know, 5 minutes before it washes out. I do it, you know, sometimes 90 seconds, sometimes 5 minutes. And what looks like a black spot in the sky, for all the world, all I would ever know had been there was a black spot in the sky until I did that with my telescope. And there's this majestic, flowing nebula of red and purple and sometimes green colors and amazing beauty and majesty. And it's obviously there. My camera was able to see it, but I would never see it with my eyes. And I think, oh, that's my world. I would never interact with it. I would never experience it whatsoever. It is part of the cosmos. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. Of course it exists. But that's not what we mean, and that's not how we experience the reality of the world we actually live in. I mean, think of the data. Just think of the data, the information, that we could access, that we do have access to, but we just don't access it. We just don't bother with it. We're not paying attention to background noises. We're not listening to all the sounds that are happening around us all the time, all the humming and buzzing. And I lived in a house right next to a train, not right next to, but, you know, within a tenth of a mile of a train track. There was just one street of houses between us and the train. And I mean, sideways, like it ran parallel with the train. So we heard the train, like when we were buying the house, we stepped into it and they closed the door and we were talking to the realtor and it's like, oh, we got to pause while the realtor, hang on while the train goes by. And then we start the conversation again. It's like, oh, that's going to be a problem. The realtor said, you're going to get used to it. You're not even going to notice it. It's like, I don't think that's going to happen. But we did love the house, so we bought it. And it's like, okay, well, we'll just live with the train sounds. We didn't live with the train sounds. They were with us for a few weeks and then they just ceased to exist. And I mean 25... You know, I said 25. It was more like 75 trains a day, which sounds ridiculous, but that's one every 20 or 30 minutes going by. It was a realistic thing that trains were there all the time and they were not a part of the picture. We never heard them. They were just out of the reality. Background noises, that's what I'm talking about. automatic actions. You don't know when you're scratching your nose or whatever. I could tell a long story about that when I was first starting out preaching and did it all the time. I had to have a friend of mine, a lady who was a member of my church when I was in my teens, stand in the back of the church and raise her hand for me every time I scratched my nose while I was preaching so I would stop doing it. And that's what it took. It took her raising her hand, and I would go, oh, for crying out loud, my hand is up there scratching my nose. I wasn't picking my nose. I was scratching my nose. Hear my words. Anyway, the point is, the same. But by the way, it's the same thing with the daytime moon. I just picked one out at random, and I got this from somebody who said they saw it on Twitter, so I don't know for sure it was there. I assume it was. I didn't look it up. But in December, but I see things like this all the time, so I have no doubt this was actually there. In December of 23, there was a well-followed tweeter who said this. They had a picture of, and they said full moon. It wasn't full. Please. They don't know what they're talking about with moons. Do some astrophotography. Anyway, the point is, there was a waxing gibbous moon that was out, and it was still daytime, obviously, and they took the picture. Blue sky, moon, and this was their quote. This was their caption under it. This is December of 2023 from a person who doesn't seem completely unintelligent. This full moon is out in the middle of the day. That's not supposed to happen. Like it's some kind of conspiracy, or the world's coming to an end, or what's happening. It happens constantly. The moon is up during the day as much as it's up during the night. It's the I am beside myself with frustration about that. And yet I read years ago a quotation that said something like 30%, 25%, something like that, of all people do not know that the moon is up sometimes during the day. I'm beyond words. I can't even imagine why, but it's because we don't look up. This is how we are. We have access to all kinds of information we never take advantage of. And that's not, those things are evidence that when we say, this is the world I live in, what we really mean is, this is all the stuff I interact with or that I think I could interact with. That's really what we're talking about. So the first challenge in this conversation is simply to recognize that, to get past the naivety of thinking, well, I have a perfect interaction with the objective world around me, and I understand that world, and that's the one I live in. No, it's not. We live in a world that's constructed by all the things we put in it, and they're real things. I'm not saying they're not there. I'm not saying we don't interact with them. I'm just saying it's a limited set of things, and it's the things that we've placed and identified and given names to and made sense of and know how to walk around without stubbing our toes and stuff like that. The second step, just go with me with that one. If you can hang on to it for a minute, in a moment, I think you'll recognize, oh, okay, I can go with that. The second step, it really important, and this one's a short one. We can handle it, or I think it is. We can handle this one pretty quickly. The second step we have to take, first, is getting over the naivety of thinking our world is just the objective cosmos that's out there. Second step is to realize how we relate to others and use the world in those relationships. That is, where does the world fit in the way I relate to other human beings? And I'm going to give it to you just in two lines from poems that I've talked about in great detail before and encourage you to go back and listen to if you get an opportunity. I've talked about The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock before. Encourage you to listen to that discussion. Talked about Robert Frost's Mending Wall. Beautiful, magnificent poem that I encourage you to listen to. Both of them are just fantastic. Completely different nature as poems, but they are fantastic. J. Alfred Prufrock, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock in T.S. Eliot's poem, you know, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. He has this line that says, there will be time. And I didn't go back and look it up, so this is an approximation, but it's pretty close. It's probably exactly right. There will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. That statement is a perfect expression of what I'm talking about. There is a sense of frustration in it. Oh, I've got to put on a face before I can go out there and meet all the other people with their faces. This is in a poem largely about just a person needing to make a decision to get out and relate to other people. That's part of what's going on in it. So in one sense, there is a, hey, get up, just get ready, wash your face, go outside and see everybody. But in another sense, there's an acknowledgement that even when you do that, and this is an important underlying theme in that poem, that even when you do that, what is it you're meeting out there? It's not you're meeting other people and you're getting to know other people. You're getting to know other faces. And they're not just faces that happen to show up out there. They're faces that prepared themselves to show up out there. So it's more like using the word face as the word mask in that way of taking it. It's ambiguous. You're supposed to use it both ways. It's your face. It's your mask. But preparing your face means you're putting on something. It's not just you. But that's part of what's required to get out there and meet the other people who put on something so that they could meet you. So that face, that premise, that mask that you put on is vital. It is both the thing that unites and separates you. You see how it relates to what we're talking about with the world and the table idea. Exactly the same thing with, and this one's more directly and immediately exemplifies, it more immediately and directly exemplifies what I'm talking about here. Robert Frost's Mending Wall. Just the ambiguity in the title makes the point. Mending Wall. The ambiguity of the title is that the man in the poem, are fixing the wall. They are mending the wall that's been broken down. And so it's called Mending Wall, as in we're mending the wall. But it's not called Mending the Wall. It's called Mending Wall because the wall also mends the relationship between the people, which is why one of the most important lines in the poem, and again, you have to go all the way back. I mean, we haven't done this since episode 8, and I think we're on episode 160-something right now. So it's been a long time since we talked about it. But if you go all the way back there, you can hear a whole conversation about Mending Wall, the poem, or at least a significant part of it. So anyway, in the poem, the point is this line comes out repeatedly. So I won't go back and do the whole poem. You can go back and listen to that for that. But the line that's repeated that's so important to this concept of the table uniting and dividing us, in this case, it's a wall uniting and dividing us. Just like I said before, part of our world is the walls that we build. The walls that we build do this. And the line in that poem that I'm getting at is, good fences make good neighbors. It's not an original line in the poem. He even quotes it in the poem as a common saying. It's a common expression that people would use. That's how he introduces it in the poem. I don't know the origin of the original statement. I'm just getting it from Frost. But the statement is so true. I mean, it's just the reality of human life. Good fences make good neighbors. You need boundaries in order to know how you can come together. Otherwise, it's chaos. It's absolute chaos. And he's not just talking about literal walls. It's not just the rock wall. I mean, it's a metaphor. Even for the morality that we have, knowing that we have a set of laws that we follow, that you drive on that side of the yellow stripe and I drive on this side of the yellow stripe, that barrier is what allows us to be on the same street together. It brings us together and it keeps us apart. You get the idea. So the first step is to realize that what we mean by world is not just the objective material reality within which we coexist. What you mean by world is all of that stuff that shapes the way we comprehend how we have to live. And then the second step is to realize that a huge part of the reality of how we relate to each other is defined by that world. It brings us together. Those objects bring us together, and they keep us apart to the extent that we can have property. We're acknowledging that I don't take your stuff. And the fact that it's yours means it's not mine, and that brings us together so that we can coexist in the same place and not kill each other, stuff like that. Okay, so you get the idea. That's the second step. Then the third step, and this is what I wanted us to get to. The third step, and this is, I think this is the more significant challenge for us, especially now and in this civil and political environment where we are right now. It's not the first time that we've had conflict as a nation or in the world with these ideologies. They're not new. There's nothing new under the sun. This is all part of the reality that we've always lived in this world. So it's not new to Christianity either. So the third step I want us to take is to find the table around which believers gather. And that table, we would recognize, is going to both unify us, or bring us together, that is, and separate us. It has to do both, because that's how you have a world. And it can't be the world that everybody else has. If we have the world everyone else has, something's wrong with our Christianity. We've been made a new creation in Christ. There's something different about where we are. And so I'll give you some examples of this. I know that Hannah Arendt in her work makes a reference, just a passing reference, to Augustine and his reliance on charity as that table, the thing that brings us together. So let me read you what that language actually is from Augustine himself, so that you get what he's talking about and how he describes it. But notice how it, built into this, as I'm reading it to you, it's just one paragraph. It's a little longish, but not terrible. As I'm reading it to you, sorry, I mean, I know none of it's terrible. It's fantastic. It's Augustine. But I know it can be boring to hear somebody read somebody else's material. But this is pretty fascinating, because he does talk about charity as the affection that brings us together with our neighbors, but inherently has to tie that to lust, the thing that separates us from others or that creates conflict with others. And I want you to hear how he's talking about the being joined together and separated by this same thing, charity. So I mean by charity, he says, that affection of the mind which aims at the enjoyment of God for his own sake and the enjoyment of oneself and one's neighbor in subordination to God. So it's giving us our own presence, our own existence, the enjoyment of oneself, but also of one's neighbor in subordination to God. And then he gives the opposite of charity, which he refers to as lust. So by lust, I mean that affection of the mind, which aims at enjoying oneself and one's neighbor and other corporeal things without reference to God. Again, what lust, when unsubdued, does towards corrupting one's own soul and body is called vice, but what it does to injure another is called crime. So basically what this is establishing, just so you'll understand the context and why I'm reading it, this establishes the basis for all of the virtues, all of the vices, all of our understanding of what's right and wrong and the rules that we follow. They all fall into the category of charity when it's applied to our relationship with God or our relationship with ourselves or our relationship with others. Or lust, in contrast to that, defined in relation to neglecting God or our neighbor or ourselves in some way. So when it's corrupting your own soul, lust, then it's called vice. But what it does to injure another is called crime. So you can hear all the rules being established by this one thing, charity, which is the table that brings us together to coexist and creates the boundaries by which we know how to maintain our separation appropriately, so that we're not committing crimes against each other, for instance. So these are the two classes, he says, but into which all sins may be divided, about lust as the opposite of charity. But the vices come first, for when these have exhausted the soul and reduced it to a kind of poverty, it easily slides into crimes in order to remove hindrances to or to find assistance in its vices. In the same way, he gives the opposite, now charity, bringing us together. What charity does with a view to one's own advantage is prudence. But what it does with a view to a neighbor's advantage is called benevolence. So here, prudence comes first because no one can confer an advantage on another which he doesn't himself possess. Now, in proportion as the dominion of lust is pulled down, in the same proportion is that of charity built up. The only reason I'm bringing up all of that paragraph is to point out that everything about what brings us together and gives us the boundaries within which we have to function when we are together is that charity. That's what allows us to coexist. I'm not Augustinian. I'm not trying to follow him to define a new governing principle for America or something like that. It's got nothing to do with that, but simply the point that built into Christianity is this fundamental question about what's going to bring us together and define the boundaries within which we maintain that relationship that we have. So what, I mean, it just seems like it's begging to be said, and it has been throughout history, undoubtedly, that we literally, as believers, I mean, we have, and I'm not using literally, you know, the way a millennial or next gen would. I mean it literally. We literally have a table. We use that literal table figuratively in an expression of metonymy to talk about the whole of the communion, but there's literally a table there. We literally have a table that unites us, the communion table. It unites us in the death of Christ, which provides our union, communion, our community, our reason for being brought together. And that's in the death of Christ. I know it's extended beyond that to the resurrection and power of Christ and his presence and the Holy Spirit and all the basic fundamental realities of recognizing the lordship of Christ. But in the taking of the communion, what unifies us is the death of Christ, participating in his blood in taking the cup, participating in his body in taking the bread. And it's because he died that we're able to do that. That's the context within which he shares it with the disciples originally. Anyway, I'm simply saying, we have a table that unites us as believers. We come together around that table, but it also separates us. And I don't mean by that, well, we have different understandings and interpretations of it, and some people are open and closed communion and cracked communion and all the other versions of communion. And then we say, but you're not part of the Episcopal communion or the Anglican communion, but you're part of the African communion or this. I don't mean that at all. Even within a single church, the table separates us as believers. The language of 1 Corinthians 11 really makes this obvious, both in how it brings us together and in how it separates us. In 1 Corinthians 11, the emphasis by the end of the chapter, where he's describing how we take the Lord's Supper, where Paul tells the Corinthian church, which, by the way, was torn apart in more ways than they should have and should have been unified more than they were, but also needed to recognize, and this is where he dwells on it in the book of 1 Corinthians, also needed to recognize the variety of gifts that was in the church that kept all of them as separate parts of the congregation. It's in that same context, right before chapter 12, where all the talk of the gifts are, that this comes up in 1 Corinthians 11:28. Let a person examine himself, singular, himself then, and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself. That's why many of you, because we're all together in the communion, are weak and ill, and some have died. But if we judge ourselves truly, we would not be judged. But when we're judged by the Lord, we're disciplined so that we may not be condemned along with the rest of the world. We're brought together, you know, together as a body. So we're different from the rest of the world. We don't have the world everyone else has. We have something else. We have this table of communion. So then he goes on in verse 33 to say in 1 Corinthians 11, my brothers, when you come together to eat, wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, you come together to eat. You come together to the table, but you wait for one another. If anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. This is not to rush. This is not so that you can get to the food. It's so that when you come together, it will not be for judgment. About the other things, I'll give direction when I come. The whole nature of what he's saying in that is going back and forth between being drawn together to the table so that individuals can handle the thing that God wants them to deal with by themselves before him. He wants them to take care of it. If we would judge ourselves, and he's saying that about each one, let a person examine himself. That's the exact quote from verse 28. That's the ESV translation, but I mean it's singular. It's about the individual. Okay, so if you get that picture, all I'm trying to get to is this. This is, I'm coming to a close. I told you, one episode. We're doing it, one episode. It is certainly the case that the table, and I mean in this case, the communion, but I mean it more broadly. I'm using the communion as the metonymy of just Christianity. It's Christianity that brings us together. It is certainly the case that the table that joins and separates believers is not the same world that everyone else lives in. It's not the world that non-believers live in. It's not the world that those who don't acknowledge the lordship of Jesus live in. That means we're not joined together. As believers, the thing that brings us together is not, nor it's not all of those normal affinities. The nature of wealth. Are you wearing the same kind of clothes we wear? Do you fit the same economy that we fit? It's not our race. It's not our career. It's not our family structure. All the people with children get together. All the singles get together. It can't be any of that. It certainly can't be political commitments. That's a normal affinity. It makes sense that people gather together around that affinity, but that's not the table of Christ. That's not the thing that judges us before him. So instead, what we, you know, because we're believers, we realize the richness of being brought together around him, around Christ, and yet not being made a monolith. We don't come to Christ and then all have to wear Gloria Vanderbilt jeans. Thank heavens. I don't even know. Yeah, I'm a child of the 80s. I mean, I was born in the 60s, whatever. I don't know. The point is, we don't all have to wear the same thing. We don't have to come to the same kind of music and say, oh, that's my favorite. We don't have to agree on our music. That's not what unifies us. What a crying shame that whole congregations are defined by the style, not of worship, because that's not worship. The style of worship. I don't even know what that would mean. The style of worship. I don't know. Do you humble yourself before God or not? No, I don't use that style of worship. What we mean by that is the style of music. What a crying shame that the style of music we like or don't like is what allows us to be drawn together around Christ. That's the world's world. That's not the table of Christ. That's not what ought to bring us together. I'm not being blithe about this. I'm not trying to be naive about it. I know we have to understand all those realities, but I don't think it even makes sense to talk about those things until we finally figure this out that I'm talking about right now. We have to realize the richness of being brought together around Christ and yet not being made into a single stone, a monolith. In that way, we get to see who we are separately. But no matter how doggedly those separations persist in us, and they will, they'll always be there, we begin to bring those to the table where the differences themselves aren't just erased. You know, do you speak Greek or Hebrew? Do you speak English or Spanish? I mean, you're still going to speak that language. They're not erased. They don't just go away, but they can be transformed in their nature and application by the table that brought us together. I can't just come as a Republican or Democrat and say, well, I'm going to reject all the Democrats, and then say, and my Republicanism isn't going to be changed at all by the fact that I believe in the Lordship of Jesus and the resurrection from the dead. Something about the way I am who I am ought to be transformed by the Lordship of Christ in a way that allows me to be brought together to the table with anyone who's recognizing the Lordship of Christ. They were brought to the table. I mean, it's the table that defines us as believers. This is part of what it means to live in a different world than those who do not believe. Charity draws us together and makes us love each other. Differences behind, table of Christ before.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.